This episode of Total Network Operations is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer is a toggle-ready network security platform built for modern businesses. It combines VPN, access control, and threat protection into a single easy-to-use platform. There's no hardware and no complex setup, just secure connections and full control in less than 10 minutes. It's easy to start, scale, and integrate. It works with your existing infrastructure across Windows, macOS, iOS, Android, and Linux. NordLayer is for business owners, IT admins, and cybersecurity conscious listeners, which honestly is all of us, with a full range of features and benefits, including automated onboarding and offboarding with SCIM, the open standard for cross-domain identity management. And we love automation in our network and security operations, and much, much more. Pricing starts at $8 per user per month with three plans to choose from, plus special rates for teams with more than 50 seats. For TeenOps listeners, there's a special offer. You get up to 22% off NordLayer yearly plans, plus an additional 10% off with the coupon code TNOperations-10. On top of all that, you can try NordLayer risk-free with their 14-day money-back guarantee. Go to NordLayer.com/TNOperations. That's NordLayer.com/TNOperations. And now, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Total Network Operations, the podcast dedicated to hardworking network operators like you who deliver all the packets and want to see what's going on. Here on TeenOps, we call out lighthouse ideas in NetOps so you can take away useful ideas and make informed decisions for your network and your team. I'm Scott Robon. This is our first episode of TeenOps on the road at NANOG 92 in Toronto. Really appreciate the NANOG folks for supporting us and letting me take some space and talk to really interesting people like the gentleman you're about to meet. Today, we have Doug Madorey. Doug is the man who sees the internet, and he'll explain what that means. If I were to assign a meme to Doug, he might be the most interesting man in internet infrastructure, but we'll leave meme creation to other people we know. I'm fascinated by what Doug does. And if you're not familiar with his work, I hope this conversation will be the start for you to understand the intelligence that he gathers and makes useful. Doug, welcome to TeenOps. Tell us about yourself, what you do, what's important to you as a leader in network operations.
All right, thanks for having me. So my title is Director of Internet Analysis for Kentik. And so what I do is we have a lot of data that we collect as a company. And so I use that data to find insights to either help with the development of some of our product capabilities. I find things that relate to things in the news. Sometimes there's geopolitical events or disasters. And then there's things like I'm here at NANOG to talk about RPI, routing security. And so that's another area where I participate in industry conferences to talk about what are the where we are with some of the concepts and routing these days. So BGP is one of my areas, one of my specialties, but I do, I use a lot of this data to tell a variety of different types of stories.
So you didn't start out right where you are today. Give us a little of your superhero origin story. How did you get here?
Sure. So let's see. I started in 2009 with a small boutique BGP company called Renesas, and I had been hired on to. As a lowly data QA guy, and they asked, would I be willing to write stuff? And I was like, sure, because nobody there, nobody wanted to do any writing. We had some big clients that we had to write reports for and write up stuff. And I was like, I can write, I guess. I was willing to do it. And when I got to the company and started to understand. It was my first time in the internet industry working with BGP data. I knew it from Cisco exams. That was the extent of my interaction with BGP. And then I was like, this is like really cool stuff, and we have this really neat perspective on the internet. And the internet is so important to human civilization these days. Every story has an internet component in it anymore. That there's like a lot of potential here. And so I was like, I want to try to get really good at this. And so then I just put my nose to the grindstone. And again, I was mostly just doing data QA. So we had all kinds of like classification things in our software and other types of conclusions that needed to get checked, or we'd figure out how they went wrong and fix them. And so I just spent a lot of time in the data. And what I I've argued ever since is that, you know, that data QA position is super important. And it's a way that I got to be really intimately familiar with the data. And the other thing is that trying to identify any types of novelties in the data, it's the same process to find something that, oh, this is an error and it needs to be fixed, or this is something really interesting and ought to be studied or told to the world. A lot of the same tools are used in both things. It's just trying to, how do you pick out when something is anomalous? And is it anomalous because we made a mistake, or is it anomalous because this is a really interesting development? I would do the same, same processes. I'd be fixing geolocation, fixing, other types of things, and then also identifying, BGP hijacks that got headlines, or other types of things that, that come up. But anyway, so data QA, I think, is a underappreciated position in a data company is a good place to get started. So I kind of grew from there. And then one of the founders was a guy named Jim Cowie. And so he had kind of developed a practice of this, using internet measurement to comment on geopolitical events. That was already something that he had kind of established that, and somewhat established Renesas as a player in that space. And mostly just to his broad intellectual curiosity. He was just like endlessly, super intelligent guy that could, talk about anything at a expert level. And so I kind of became an understudy a little bit to him, where I would help, I would do my own stuff, but then occasionally I'd try to augment some of his presentations or help him, with some details on things. And then when the Arab Spring came around, which is 2011, that was a big time for us, because we were we became during that time kind of the world's leading technical source for these shutdowns, and internet shutdowns was still kind of a new
countries limiting access to
It started with Egypt in January 2011, which is now a lifetime ago, but for us that was when that country went down, we were at the forefront documenting what took place, the timing, what stayed up.
How do you know it went down? So, like, what are the mechanics of? Yeah. We could tell that Egypt is off the air.
So in this case, one thing we did get a tip like the day prior that there had been an Egyptian engineer who said that they had been given an order. Like at that time, there had been days of protests in Tahrir Square, and so the
so you're watching geopolitical events. You know things are hot.
Yeah, we knew there was this potential that somebody had said that they had been given an order to prepare if they needed to shut services down, and so like, oh, okay, well, let's keep an eye on this. And then we had IRC based communication at the time. And
IRC.
Yeah.
Internet relay chat for those who are not familiar with it.
It's funny. I went to that company. I was like, wow, we're all on IRC. And I had last used IRC like 10 plus years earlier. And I was like, oh, that's fine. So then Jim writes out, it's like, if anybody can help me, I think, Egypt just went offline. And so how we would know from our perspective was, all the BGP routes that define all the IP address space of Egypt left the global routing table. So by definition, that would mean that anyone on the internet now has no way to send any packets to anything in Egypt. And so we were in this great position where we had already had to build for the products that we're selling. We had to have really good geolocation of all the prefixes of the internet. Like, what are the ISPs? What are the address space that they announce? Who do they get transit from? That was kind of part of one of our products that we would sell, was trying to navigate the world of internet transit in any country. And so we could pull up at our fingertips any country second by second. Where's the address space? How is it? Who's originating it? Who's transiting it? How's that changing through time? And so then when this shutdown, thankfully it was, very visible in BGP, which makes it really simple. Like if there's no routes, there's
can't forward traffic.
End of story. Yeah. I mean, you can have an outage, and there's been many different variations of this. You can have an outage where the routes stay up and they just administratively take the traffic down or something. Like there's like lots of different ways to skin the cat. But in this case, it was routes were down. And like, okay, well then that's that's super easy. You can be very confident that there's no traffic coming in and out of the country. So then I was kind of helping Jim with that coverage. By the end of it, I think Syria was the last country to have a shutdown in June. I wrote my own thing for that and was handling my own press inquiries on that. And yeah, they were, it was very supportive. And so I've always said, you know, had Jim kept it as the founder of the company and the guy who had kind of created this practice on his own, had he kept it to himself, I never would have held it against him. But he
secret sauce. Yeah.
But he was very gracious to share. And now we, you know, within a year or two, now we had two people who could independently write this stuff, handle press inquiries, you know. And so this is all part of a marketing strategy, obviously. But you know, we, I think partly why we're good at it is we do also care, and it is of interest. Yeah, so then eventually we got acquired by Dyn, Dyn DNS, and then Jim kind of left to go start another company, and so then I became it for all of the all the analysis, all of the media stuff, all the conference stuff, and yeah, those years were pretty cool. Every day I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many
sure.
stories, there's so many neat things. I just want to see if I can just capture all of them. There's all kinds of hijacks going on. It was still pretty wild. I think things have settled down in the world of BGP since then, but right then we were just kind of getting better at pulling the covers up on what's going on and be like, can we find all the hijacks in the world? Can we find all the all the different leaks that are going on? And so then once you started to look into it, you're like, oh my gosh, there's a lot here. And you're like, okay, so now we're like, what stories do we want to tell out of this? But
let's pick that apart a little bit.
Yeah.
So like, let's talk about the tooling. And I see at least two buckets of tooling. You know, you're looking at detailed route information, you know, from sources all over, and you don't work for a big provider, right? So you must be looking at Looking Glass or other route view information from somewhere. And then you've got the geopolitical weather and other tools that you must use. And then there's how you put it all together. Like let's talk about those three of those in order. Where do you go? What CLI commands do you type? You don't have to go in that level of detail, but where are you getting that detailed info from?
So let's see, I guess there's two main data types that I'm spending time with these days. So there's BGB data. I make a lot of use out of route views. Kentik has actually thousands of full table collections as part of the operation of the company. Some of that's available easily. A lot of it is, you know, piped into the product, and not necessarily always easy for me to play with, kind of thing. I get a lot of value out of the route views data set, and as far as BGP. Goes. And then I feel like I've developed a lot of techniques over the years to find interesting stuff out of BGP.
Type into grep and you know the search strings you're looking for and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's maybe a little more to that, but
I don't want to make it oversimplified.
Yeah, I mean that's more of it is I think the trick that is not well understood with BGP is that to be really good at it, you have to pay the price of keeping state and keeping state of like how do, you know, for this route, how do all hundreds or thousands of ASs have it in its table through time, and how do we cognitively understand those changes? It's a tricky thing. So people, when they first get started, they kind of are counting messages or counting how many updates. You're like, oh, this isn't useful. The updates are these, you know, I think of it as a I'm trying to think from what's the right terminology here, but these are observables of a hidden state that you can't directly see.
You're not in the router. You're not in the
exactly,
pairing router.
Exactly.
You don't have the messages and the state.
Exactly.
Changes.
Sure. Your only clue are these messages. But you don't want to get too caught up on those messages and be like, oh, I got 11 today and 20 tomorrow. Like, it doesn't matter. And some of them are redundant or many of them are redundant, and the counts don't, you know, they might be indicative of something, but what you're trying to do is keep track of this hidden state and understand the dynamics in the hidden state through the messages. Anyway, so that's BGP. I make a lot of my own tools that I use for that. And then
would you call that automation skill set? Or what do you, give us a couple examples or one example of the tools that you have created and used to supplement what you're looking at?
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say it's automation, but it's basically doing what I said a minute ago of, like, let's say you're interested in a whole bunch of routes. You want to understand, you know, what are the changes in, have there been some sort of material change of how these things are routed through the internet and in what way? That is a highly dimensional question. And so to do that, you have to kind of build the state of all of these prefixes of how do all these ASs, how do we converge all the AS paths into one idea? And then how do we represent any kind of changes through time? It's not like a tool or something. Okay. It's definitely not automation, I don't think.
It's fine. You're aggregating a lot of data. You have some high level understanding of how things interact. Your data QA background must be super useful to.
It's good for checking. Honestly, like with BGP, you know, what's interesting here is that unlike physics or something else, these ASNs that appear in BGP data, it's not like an atom. This is a company that has a history and has, you know, tendencies, and maybe there's, you know, it's got some strategy and stuff. So knowing who these players are is helpful to know, like, oh, that, you know, at this point, I have a pretty good trained eye where I can look at, look at the AS path and be like, yeah, I think that guy's screwing up here. And this, you know, someone else, you know, and I understand, you know, 9 times out of 10, I can just look at it and be like, I see what's happening. For BGP, that's the one data set. And then what's very cool about working at Kantic is that we have a lot of NetFlow. And so the company, the primary product is NetFlow and analytics. Most people do a SaaS thing where they're sending the NetFlow to us. We process it and turn it into, you know, observability insight for them. Lots of people love the tool. And then we also have an arrangement where there's some rules of the road I have to follow. For those folks that have sent that NetFlow to us, we can use this in an aggregate form. So we're not outing them or breaking through their stuff. We're not, you know, so I've got a bunch of rules, but like when I'm looking at, you know, country X goes offline, I don't think anybody's too concerned that it came from this client or this other client. Like I'm looking at the other end of that, of the NetFlow record. So what's very cool as a guy who spent a lot of time doing BGP analysis is that you'd see routing things, routing leaks, routing hijacks, but you wouldn't really know. It would stand the reason that a packet got impacted, but you don't know. Like I really, you know, it could be these are routes that carry no traffic and they experienced a leak, and so the operational impact is zero. Like we wouldn't have any way to know, and so that's something that we're able to do. I'm able to do, which is like when I first got to the company, I was like, can I do that? Like, oh, that'd be really cool. I'm like the only person on earth that would find this fascinating. But it's something I still do. Like there's, you know, routing leaks still occur with some regularity, and so we can go then pivot. And the way that Kantic works is that when the NetFlow records get ingested, each one's decorated with a bunch of attributes, and one of them is the AS path as seen by the router that generated the record, and that's super helpful because then I can go back and query like, all right, well, there's a routing leak that has this AS triple, that it's this AS, this AS, this AS. And when you see those three, it's part of this leak because this guy was, you know, leaking routes from one transit provider to another. I can craft a query and just go across all of our data and be like, did anybody see records that were sent at this time through this with a AS path that included this triple? And it'll come back like, yeah, here it is. And here's, you know, 27 different ways you could break this traffic down to understand the impact. Like, that's really cool because we always just deal with the theoretical. And now I can see like, this is actual operational traffic. This is traffic that was misdirected as a result of this. And then I got into answering questions. Again, I might be the only person who finds this interesting, but like when you have a leak, you know, a lot of times people are concerned about, or some sort of routing misdirection, some sort of mishap. you're concerned about kind of two things. Maybe there's more, but two things come to mind of how much traffic was misdirected down the wrong path. And whether it's, for a while, we were all concerned about China hijacking things and stuff. Is there traffic getting redirected through mainland China for some reason, or just going a long route due to an accident? Or how much traffic is getting dropped because either due to congestion or increased latencies due to the more circuitous path it has to take. What are those two, impacts? I don't actually have a rule of thumb that one is more than the other. It really depends so far, but I always go and check. I'm like, I want to know, A, how much traffic can I see was misdirected as a result of this mishap? And how much traffic was potentially dropped? And the way I do that is I'll take just like the most impacted prefixes, because each in a routing leak, I'll measure how the amount of impact to a prefix would be, like how far did the leaked version propagate? And if it only was seen by like one AS, then it's probably not, probably didn't affect very many people. If it's seen by 200, then it's probably, it's really propagated through the internet. And so I'll try to come up with some sort of a cutoff and like, all right, I'm not worried about these routes that didn't really propagate very far, but the ones that did propagate far, do we have a baseline of traffic that we normally see that comes through this? And again, it depends on the incident, but sometimes you will see a baseline of traffic, there'll be some sort of routing incident, and you'll see a drop until the routing incident is over. And so I look at that. It's to your eye, it's very obvious that there's been some sort of impact. There's a drop, it comes back. That's when the leak took place. And so that's your, a measure of how much traffic was lost as opposed to misdirected, but both things can happen. But I've never been able to answer any of those questions until I had NetFlow to back this up and be like, yeah, sure. There's actually something to this. Cause a lot of it was just intuition and I can't go back in time to look at old events, but I do like each time there's a leak, like there was something this weekend, a small thing. And I go and look and like, all right, what's it look like as far as, traffic, getting misdirected and so that those are the two data types I use primarily. We also do a lot of performance monitoring of just measuring latencies, trace routes, pings, that kind of stuff. And I've got another project along those lines, but we can if we have time, we can talk about
that. Yeah, well, let's see where that goes. Yeah. I would say on all the tooling and skill set that you just mentioned, there's like, if you're in a network operations role and you're used to really watching what's happening with BGP peerings for your network, that's you could become like a Doug Maggiore someday. Yeah. you have a start on like people from a strong operational background who understand, the types of routes that you accept and you carry across your network. That seems like a necessary input to, your thinking and how you analyze things.
Sure.
But that's not all. So let's move to that second bucket, the non-route view pieces. Are you reading the Washington Post? Are you, do you subscribe to other news feeds? How do you assess what's happening, not at the technical layer, but associating it to other events in the real world?
I think I personally have a strong interest in current events, international affairs.
Sure.
I think some of that comes from my time in the military. I think some of that just comes from my upbringing. My dad was an engineer at IBM his whole career, or just about his whole career, was at RCA and then IBM.
Was that at Poughkeepsie?
Yeah, Poughkeepsie. Yep, sure. Yeah, that's right. Yep. I grew up in Poughkeepsie. So before that, he was at RSA working on some of the early satellites long ago. But he's a mainframe, writing libraries, low-level code, kind of hardcore stuff.
Mainframe's back, baby. Yeah. The AI data center. So
yes, some would say it never went away.
Exactly.
But and then my mom was a journalism major and was always worked in that kind of, she ended up doing a lot of copy editing, but like journalism was definitely her passion. So I'm an interesting mix, I think, of the two, my mom and my dad, because I think some of the stuff you're getting at is coming, that's my mom's side.
Okay.
Of the,
very cool.
Being a news junkie and, like I said, serving overseas and stuff, it definitely piqued my interest in, just, that world and keeping tabs of it. But yeah, and then I was, it was very fortuitous going back to joining Renesis and Jim Cowie of like seeing how he was relating this internet measurement data to global events. Like, this is really fascinating stuff. And not only is it interesting, it's also like there's a role for this to, you know, corroborate reports or to tell bits of the story that aren't being told in other ways. And so we felt like there was a kind of a calling to do this. And I've told people in the past when I joined Renesis, I'd done a few different jobs, but then I was like, this is I was very happy. And I felt like there's a guy, David Carr, was a media critic for the New York Times, and he wrote this a memoir a while back. The guy passed away, but he made a comment about how when he arrived at the Times, he had an immigrant's love for the place. Like, he had been everywhere, and he loved it more than the people that were there. And I felt like when I got to Renesis, there was already a team in place, but I had an immigrant's love. Like, I was there.
Great way to put it.
I loved it more than the natives when I arrived. And I was like, y'all don't know. I've done a bunch of other stuff that's not as fun. And this is fun stuff. So
it's clear that you enjoy it. And I mean, I've seen you talk and heard you on other venues, right? And you really dig this stuff, right?
Thanks.
That's very clear.
This episode of Total Network Operations is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer is a toggle-ready network security platform built for modern businesses. It combines VPN, access control, and threat protection in a single, easy-to-use platform. There's no hardware and no complex setup, just secure connections and full control in less than 10 minutes. It's easy to start, integrate, and scale. NordLayer helps business owners, IT admins, and all you cybersecurity conscious teen ops listeners, which is all of you, who need to address a wide range of use cases. Business VPN services secure employee connections and company resources to prevent online threats and intellectual property leaks. Zero Trust Network Access provides access to only the right users under the right conditions. Threat protection prevents malware, ransomware, and phishing from reaching endpoints. Threat intelligence spots threats before they escalate, identifying, analyzing, and preventing internal and external risks. And of course, compliance support helps businesses meet industry regulations through granular access, encryption, and monitoring. NordLayer pricing starts at $8 per user per month with light, core, and premium plans to choose from, plus special rates for teams with over 50 seats. For TeenOps listeners, there's a special offer. You can get up to 22% off NordLayer yearly plans, plus an additional 10% off with the coupon code TNOperations-10. On top of all that, you can try NordLayer risk-free with our 14-day money-back guarantee. Go to nordlayer.com/TNOperations. That's nordlayer.com/TNOperations. And now let's get back to the show.
And then the third item of like putting it all together, putting it into reasonable analysis. Do you like to write? Have you always liked to write? Has that come later in life? How do you balance that with the other data collection stuff that you do?
Let's see. I've not always been a great writer, and I think I've just gotten better over time. Like, I think it's just like a skill, like anything else. The more you do it, the more you hone it. And now I. Rarely do I think of myself as a writer, but I kind of am. I had a colleague in another company that I collaborate with sent me a copy of his blog post and asked if I would, you know, mostly check it for technical stuff. But then I was like, like, this is passive voice. You'd like to do active voice. And like, I just kind of go through, you can eliminate the sentence and can make it tighter. And just learning the craft of trying to write so that, the reader just moves right through what you're writing. Like I think if I were to go back and look at the first stuff I wrote, it'd probably be like nails on a chalkboard to me. But now, yeah, I don't know, maybe AI can do it all for you now, but like I think it's a skill people develop.
Sure.
And you know, it's just time working on it. But I think I'm sufficiently good. I'm not Shakespeare, but I'm pretty good.
The product that you put out is helpful to lots of people. So if you're getting better, don't stop. Keep getting better. my first job out of school was working for the GAO, where and their product are these, you know, blue books, you know, so, you know, engineering, highly math intensive, did not like to write myself. I'm not saying I've retained any of these good things that I learned, but, you know, parallelism, you know, summarization, right, and writing style. Like I had some hard lessons in some of that early in my career too, but I think I've gone further away from actually writing product versus.
Or even like a blog post, you kind of like want to come in, get some attention, give somebody understand what this thing is going to be about.
Yep.
And then you can kind of go back and tell that story, but you have to come in and like you would in a first paragraph of a news article. So I think there's some, one day I'll go back and look at some journalism stuff and you're like, oh yeah, this is what I was doing. Like, but we just kind of learned that, again, Jim and the other guys that would write would give me some, tips when I was first getting started. Like, here's how to make this better. And, you know, from the writing perspective, I don't know. I think at this point you mentioned like the interest and passion. I feel like on any given day, I've got like five or six things, like it's just burning in me to write and I just don't have time to get to it. But I really want to, feel like I need to, I don't know if I even need to tell the world. I'm mostly kind of writing for my own,
sure.
Like I'm the reader of what I'm writing and I want to, entertain and inform, the other me that is reading this.
Right.
And then, there's this embodiment of, you know, like I'll see the stats of, you know, whatever thousands of hits or, you know, something like that. And like, oh, well, that did well, or that did less well, or, you know, like, and I also have a kind of a feel for what's probably going to be better, good or not. But then these are just statistics. And every once in a while, I'll be at a conference with someone and be like, oh, I read all your stuff. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually one of the humans that's reading this. It's not just the number on
real
the
feedback.
WordPress, you know, Google Analytics thing. But, it's neat to meet the people that, read and, get something out of what I write.
Well, I think that's the first time I had the courage to actually say hi to you at an ANOG meeting years ago.
Okay.
It's like, oh, that's the guy who wrote that. So, you know, being open and being accessible to folks to be able to have conversations at events like this is like super helpful to the normal folk, you know, the smaller folk like us running around.
Hey, we're a small community. We're all in a community. Like, there's no, I'm not in any kind of ivory tower here. I'm walking the halls here. I'm having.
Do you have the Dartmouth? You have the Dartmouth shirt on, though. So, you know, all good. Let's talk a little bit about route hijacking. You mentioned that a couple times in the conversation.
Sure.
Just for folks that aren't familiar about it, what is the problem there? And you're interested in helping solve that problem in some very specific ways. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, when people talk about BGP, one of the issues that comes up is the lack of security that's inherent in the protocol. And this manifests itself in a variety of different types of problems. When I speak to people about this, I usually try to get across the point. This is like a constellation of issues. Like, it's not like there's one problem that we will have one fix for this one problem. There's a spectrum. And on one end of the spectrum, there's just fat finger mistakes of one type or another, that, you know, at a time in the past used to bring down half the internet, you know, like to be, people, accidentally announcing a bunch of, originating a bunch of routes they're not supposed to, or, passing routes in a way they're not supposed to. So there's these mistakes, and then there's on up to what we, in the business kind of call a determined adversary. So this is somebody who's, you have a bad actor who's quite clever and understands the weaknesses of all the security mechanisms and is determined to defeat them, to pull off some sort of caper. And so in recent years, there's been a few cryptocurrency attacks where there's probably all related to the same group that's pretty smart about how to pull off, you know, BGP hijack, DNS hijack, all kinds of things like in concert with this attack, and they've made off with a lot of money. That's a harder problem, and we have to kind of work our way up to it, because you could also look at the whole thing and be like, how are we gonna do this? And this, you gotta, you know, deploy some sort of security product or mechanism to the whole internet, which is, you know, 100,000, you know, ASs or something. It just seems an intractable problem. And so I think, you know, what people had started to come up with years ago, there's quite a few mechanisms that are in play these days that are helping us. The one that we get talked about a lot is RPKI, specifically ROV, Route Origin Validation, is an application that runs on the RPKI infrastructure. And the way that works is that a resource holder, so if you have IP address space, then let's say you're in North America, you would go, with very few exceptions, most people are going to use the RIR to do this for them. You can, if you're quite sophisticated, you might do this. It's even Comcast isn't doing that. Like it's like they'll use Aaron. Like most people just go, they have a service that'll set up, and you can create a ROA, route origin authorization, to say what is the AS that should be originating this, and then optionally, there's, you know, what's the max prefix length that we should see on a route. And so you can also, I mentioned optionally because I think not everyone knows that that's an option. You can leave that off where you're just checking on the origin and you're not worried about the prefix length. Because I don't know, when I look at you can computationally go and find all of the RPKI invalid routes that are in circulation at any given time. And most of them, it's a max prefix length setting that they haven't updated. They changed how they routed something. They never go back and change the ROA. And now the two things are out of sync. And now you've got a lot of ASs that are rejecting these routes and they don't propagate as far. They're probably leading to connectivity issues. But
so it's a new maintenance thing that people need to do when they change what they're advertising.
So either have a plan for how to keep those prefix length settings in the row as up to date as your routing changes, or you can also just leave it off if that's going to be too cumbersome and you're just checking on who should originate it with. That probably isn't going to change that much. It should be pretty rare that the origin changed. And the origin in this case on an AS path, this is the rightmost AS that's assumed to be the origin of the interpreted as the origin of the route. So you'd create a ROA, and then separately, there's kind of two actions. The other actions, you have ASs that are rejecting invalids. When they get a route that doesn't match the information that's in the ROA, they're going to reject that announcement. And these days, we have a lot of large telecoms that are rejecting invalids, and there's a lot of downstream benefit to that. We have all but I think one, depending on your definition of the transit free zone or who's in the cabal there, it's probably just one that hasn't adopted this, but for all the others, there's a great deal of benefit that the rest of the internet gets from them rejecting invalids, because the when you have if you were to announce a route that's invalid, it really can't propagate very far, and if it can't propagate far, then it can't disrupt traffic. And so I think it's been a success story in that, you know, again, if you were to think of like how to start a security thing that would try to, you'd like to get the whole internet to adopt it, this is like a really daunting kind of thing. And you're never going to get 100%
right
adoption, but can you get enough that it's sufficiently the benefit outweighs the costs of the work? And I think we've arrived at that point. But that's not the only. There's also like peer lock and just IRR filtering. There's ASPA. There's a few other techniques that are in play. One thing that's nice about RPKI ROV is that there's one ground truth for the whole world. People can study it. You can go pull down the data. You can see what complies, what doesn't. With IRR based filtering, there's a lot of different registries people use or databases people will use. There's variability between one and the other. There's no guarantee that they're all consistent across each other, so it makes it hard to study. It's also makes the whole system a little unpredictable, but that's another technique people will use. Like a transit provider would apply, you look at their customer and say like, all right, what's your let's say they have an AS set is another mechanism where they say like I should be announcing these routes, and maybe I have a couple customers, so I should announce those other routes. And so then the transit provider would then automatically create kind of a whitelist of what are the prefixes that are acceptable across this interface. And so there's different implementations of how that works around the world by provider, but I think that too, with its with all of its inconsistencies, still provides a lot of benefit. I think that's also a big reason that a lot of these leaks that happen, that are still happening on a regular basis, are fairly, end up being really contained to the place that they came from, which is, that's the design, that's the system, that we're never going to have
100% no compliance.
Mistakes.
Yeah,
we're never going to have no mistakes. You know, we're going to have humans, as long as humans are typing into, you know, routers, and maybe those days are numbered, I don't know. It's all just going to be AI now. As long as us humans are typing in, we're going to make mistakes. So we have to kind of like, all right, we know we're going to make mistakes. Can we just let the, have the system kind of look out for each other, where we just don't accept these, you know, obviously wrong routes that would lead to disruptions? And like I said, there's been dozens of routing leaks so far this year. How many does the average person know? Probably zero. Probably only a real, you know, gearhead like me who lives in this space. Like, oh yeah, there's all these things. Like, but each one I look at, and you're like, it didn't really cause any impact. These routes stayed contained through one mechanism or another. It's hard to know which, you know, I don't know what's inside, you know, what each of the providers, or how, what caused these things to not propagate out. But, you know, there was, when someone announces like a bunch of more specifics ought to be globally adopted if nothing's keeping them from getting propagated. Okay, well, if you have a leak and someone's leaking out a whole slew of more specifics and they don't go anywhere, or something's keeping that in, whether that's RPKI or IR filtering or another mechanism. And I don't know, that's more the norm than it was. You know, when I first started in the space, I would write a lot about routing leaks, and there's some big ones of big origination leaks and things that would be quite disruptive. And, you know, I've, in the talks I've given in the last couple of years, I often bring up, like, what's the last, you know, really big debilitating routing leak? It's probably like the Cloudflare Verizon,
sure,
Allegheny Tech thing. That's June 2019. Okay. In internet time, that is a long time
forever ago.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so what makes it difficult as a storyteller on this topic is that, you know, the way we, the currency are these events, like these big, you know, the internet carnage or something, or this outage.
Yeah.
And so now we have all these non-events, the things that could have done something but didn't. All right, well, that's less interesting to tell that story, but I feel like there's a, I have an obligation to, as one of the few people who cares so deeply about it that I'm still tracking these incidents, to point out, like, we're still having these, and the system that we've been advocating for many years, I think, is working. And it's, yeah, it's just hard to measure. I think this is a classic, you know, security metrics issue of, like, if your security is doing well and you have no events, well, how many things didn't happen because you did what you're supposed to do? It's very hard to know. All I can say is 5.5 years is a really long time to go without a debilitating routing leak. And I have a feeling that we might be at a point where there may not be, well, at least there'll be some other terrible outage.
Sure.
But it's going to have to take a different form. That this, this on the, on that spectrum of BGP incidents, we've done a good job of addressing that. And now we got to work our way up towards the determined adversary thing, where, you know, RPKI RV can be defeated. You could falsify the origin,
sure,
and get around it. And people have done this to pull off capers. So, all right, so now we got to work on, like, how do we build off that and try to, you know, raise the price or the cost of trying to pull off this attack. And so again, we have more people now thinking about that problem and
right,
working on, like, all right, what would be, hashing out the solutions. You know, there's a debate around BGPSec. Like, is this worth it? Is it, what, you know, would partial deployment get you anything? And you know, there's varying opinions, but, like, the fact that we're you know, people thinking about this are back to that space, trying to figure out, like, okay, what would be the least ridiculous way to solve this problem and address the determined adversary thing? That's progress. And
yeah,
this is just a long, you know, it may be another 10 years before we're, like, looking at that and be like, well, this is largely solved, but it just takes a long time, and it's a big internet.
You've got to take that view, right? I mean, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I would share your pragmatic optimism You know, we have a robust distributed system that is the global internet, you know, and there isn't one number to call for, you know, who's keeping the internet up today. And getting new mechanisms to handle issues and problems takes sitting down at tables at conferences like this at IETF, working with big transit providers and small ISPs across the board to get enough consensus to agree to implement enough of these things. I know that's a horrible broad brush. I just painted everything you said with, but
you know, there's a quote I had come across. I don't know. It's attributed to Bill Gates. Maybe it's one of these things that's made up, but it's a good quote either way. That people overestimate what they can get done in a year,
yeah,
underestimate what they can get done in 10 years. And I feel like the RPKI thing is a good example of that. This was a long-term thing, and it required, you know, constant, you know, advocacy and development through a long period of time. And we wouldn't have, you couldn't have done this in a year, but right. You do it in, you know, 10 years. And I think we're now looking at that like, okay, hey, we were able to pull this off largely and the momentum's in the right direction. Now these other unsolved parts of the space, we have to kind of, have to address this now. And the risk that comes to mind for me is, We could be a victim of our own success here, where due to the successes that we've had thus far, there may be less incidents in the headlines. Although we really, like I said, we haven't just solved the determined adversary, so I think we'll probably see more of those more sophisticated attacks that involve a BGP hijack, but somebody defeating RPKI-RV. Yeah, I worry about losing momentum if we don't have incidents to keep this in top of mind. So I don't know. It's something I think about. Like the U.S. government, the federal government is now suddenly, you know, starting to get engaged on this topic, which is kind of, you know, it's
interesting, yeah, for sure.
It's, yep. And it takes, you know, those things just take a long time. Like, yeah, it's finally bubbled up and percolated, and even some of these things that have been put out in the last year or longer. From the U.S. government, you know, they cite a lot of the stuff I've written in the past, but some of these incidents, like when we're talking about like China Telecom, I mean, there hasn't been a China Telecom related thing since, like, I don't know, 2019 or something. Like, it's, we're going to go back in time here. But that's just the time frame that governments work on a different, you know, timeline.
Government speed.
Yep. But then they'll get interested in something else too. So there's like this moment where there's interest, and they're raising the issue, so we have to kind of, you know, try to get what we can out of that effort. But yeah, we'll see. But I think it's going to be many more years of us tightening up these remaining unsolved problems.
Work will outlive us, I think.
Could be.
For
could
sure.
Be, yeah.
And who knows how long you and I will be in this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's things like quantum computing, AI, like there's all things that like you and I here cannot conceive of what this space is probably going to look like in 10 years. We have these issues that we feel like we've got a handle on. They're not solved, but we're working on them. And then in 10 years, they're going to be like a whole new slate of things that you're like, holy crap. Like, how would you do it?
Well, our parents couldn't have invented this, most of our parents, right? And it'll be the same for us with our kids and their kids. This is a great place to wind this down. If I could ask you to, like, if you have a nugget or advice for people in ops roles to, like, how can they make better use of the analysis and work that you do? Is there a place you want to point them to? Is there any advice you would give, you know, that person in the NOC watching this BGP peering and saying, I don't think I should be getting this route from this neighbor, you know, how does Doug help that person?
Yeah, that's a good scenario you raised, because I feel like that's kind of the neglected side of this, where we think a lot about routes that are, you know, like some other entity announcing my address space, or they're hijacking me. The other flip side of that, because these are two-way communications, is I'm accepting routes that I shouldn't. That, I think, is a less solved issue. But, you know, the manners effort is a good place to start for somebody.
Call that out for people, MANRS.
Yeah,
what is that?
It's an acronym. Don't make me tell you what it stands for.
Sorry.
I always say mutually assured, but it's definitely not. It's this is basically a routing security advocacy program that's run now out of the Global Cyber Alliance.
Right. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So Manners has been around for a long time. This is basically an outfit that is outlining what different players on the internet should be doing to improve routing security, routing hygiene, and then like a lot of topics I've mentioned here of RKROV or IR filtering and stuff. They have resources for those. How to get started with those techniques or what ought to be what's expected based on your content provider. You're an ISP. I'm not sure how many other roles they have outlined. Internet Exchange. There's different players have different roles that they can. Things that they can do. So I think that's probably a good place to get started. And the folks over there, if someone has any questions, like I know Andrei Robuchevsky, I've known for many, many years.
Sure.
I've collaborated on things over the years on routing security. We're on this panel tomorrow here at Nanog 92. I would reach out to him. People can always write to me. I have to warn you that I love talking about this stuff. So if you get me started, I may go for a long time. But
why do you think I asked you to come do this? Right. Is there any other place you want to point people to for other active work you're putting out there? Is there a good blog or any place else?
Yeah. So I put out, I write for Kentik. Kentik has a blog post. I'm one of the writers there. And then I usually post stuff on Twitter and or X and LinkedIn. So those are the my main outlets where I'll put stuff out. I'm usually in the BGP world of those. That's mostly what I use the social media for. There's a small community of experts out there, and I think just about all of us know each other, and we all kind of pass notes or rag on each other or something. But
can be both.
Yeah.
Can be both.
I think if you reach out to anybody, they will give you a good faith referral to someone who can help out, whether it's me or folks at other companies. Yeah, you can find me on that social media or Kentik blog are probably the ways.
I usually see LinkedIn is where I usually see the first, okay, Doug's put something new out.
Okay.
And then it either takes me to the Kentik blog or I can, I find Twitter to be very useful. I know others don't feel the same way, but but it's not my first. It's not the first place I see stuff usually.
Yeah.
So Doug, it's been great to have you here today. You have this intense, joyful competency that makes it great to, I learn from you every time I hear you talk about this stuff. So thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. Thank you everyone else for tuning in to TNOPS on the road. Again, here at Nanog 92, I'd love your feedback on TNOPS, especially topics you'd like us to cover, people you'd like us to talk to. Spread the word. I want to get more people involved in this conversation. If you have feedback for me, please drop me a DM on LinkedIn, or you can send us follow-up on Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net/follow-up. Thanks again, and talk to you next time on TNOPS.